I was wearing a brand new black and olive green butter soft Pele jacket with red trimming and a gold barrel link with a Lazarus piece. Looking real clean and ready to bag these older niggas' broads as always. The block was packed when we pulled up. We parked around the corner and walked over to where Derek and his crew was posted up across from the club entrance. Derek told me they couldn't get in. We didn't care. It was like a party outside, with females roaming around who couldn't get in either. One of Derek's boys kicked it with me about this gun I've been trying to convince him to sell me for 5 months. It was the illest gun I ever seen, still is, to this day. An all-plastic Tech 22 with a 42-shot banana clip. He finally offered me some ridiculous price, like $800. It wasn't that hot. I had a 22 revolver in my pocket, so I wasn't pressed. Though the gun looked sweeter than a motherfucker, like a toy. On the walk back to the car, after 20 minutes, Money Know and I passed some guys lighting off firecrackers. Is somebody shooting at us? I pulled my gun out of my pocket discreetly. It was the night before Halloween, chilly. Why are they still blasting fireworks? When I realized it was just firecrackers, I put the piece back as quick as I pulled it out. We stopped at the corner store for White Owl cigars and soda. As soon as I walked out the store, I was surrounded by squad cars pulling up from every angle. Freeze! Don't fucking move! Get the fuck on the ground! I complied with their demands. Damn, I'm going to jail, I thought. It wasn't hard to find a gun, right in my jacket pocket. Before they threw the cuffs on, I gave the car keys to Money No. They put me in a squad car and took me downtown. It was my first time getting locked up. I flashed back to when I was 8, in the back seat of the cop car holding my pop's cuffed hands. I dropped a few tears. I was only 16 and didn't know what was going to happen. I thought I was going to prison for a long time. At the station, they took my fingerprints, mug shots, and transported me to the Tombs. I spent the night in the Tombs in downtown Manhattan, a giant building with numerous courtrooms, including the Supreme Court, and in the basement, hundreds of prisoners. The Tombs stank, filled with bums and grimy New Yorkers, whoever they arrested off the street, stuck in the holding cell together. It was every man for theyself in there. I didn't have any problems. I knew how to carry myself. I didn't sleep, paid attention. The cops kicked and slammed the door every couple of hours as they moved people in and out. Hours passed. The bullpen started to fill up, and this white man began kicking the steel door, yelling and screaming to be released. The kid I was smoking a cigarette with and I were laughing at the fool. The correction officers came in and told him to wait like everyone else, but he wouldn't shut up.
I've been in here for hours, he shouted. When do I see the judge?
The COs took him into another room and beat him up while we listened to him scream some more. Moms and Uncle Lenny came to get me out the next morning. Since I was a youthful offender, I got out ROR, released on my own recognizance. My birthday was in 2 days. I was turning 17. I ended up getting 5 years probation and 150 hours community service at St. Peter's Church in Midtown Manhattan, right around the block from Art and Design. My grandpop's old jazz buddy, Reverend Genzel, wrote letters on my behalf to hook that up. During my daily 3 hours at St. Peter's, he'd tell me stories about playing jazz with my grandpops. The church served free food for homeless people with AIDS, so I helped set up tables and chairs and put them all away. My father left New York to hide out in California. He'd been on the run for like 4 years. After resolving his jewelry store robbery case, he caught another case when the cops pulled him over on the highway and found a couple of keys of cocaine and 2 Uzis in the trunk of his car. So he went on the run again. He made connections in Cali to change his identity, but he needed his mom's help. She couldn't send money or wire it through the bank because that would leave a paper trail. So Grandma's caught a flight to Los Angeles and took me along for the ride. It was winter recess at school, so my mom's let me go. When we arrived in L.A., Michael Peters came to pick us up from the airport. Michael was a famous dance choreographer who my grandmother raised and taught to dance. He made a big name for himself by creating the dance moves for Michael Jackson's Beat It and Thriller videos. He was proud to show my grandmother how well he was doing and brought us to his mansion in the Hollywood Hills. They drank and talked about old times at the dance school while I walked around Michael's living room, admiring the pictures on his walls of him smiling with celebrities. We checked into a hotel room at Universal Studios. When I was a kid, my grandmother took me to Universal Studios theme park right next to the hotel, where they showed us how they did special effects in movies. Even though I was older now, I still wanted to go. So Michael said he would take me while we were in town. Michael was gay as hell. But I grew up around a lot of gay dudes in my grandmother's dance school, so it didn't bother me. Mike was cool. He was like family. The next day, my grandmother and I met my pops at a grimy storefront on Malcolm X Boulevard in Compton to get the fraudulent identification. The fat dude behind the desk had a 12-gauge shotgun leaning up against the wall beside him. Pops and grandmas exchanged small talk with the dude for 15 minutes, like they had friends in common. Pops gave the guy a yellow envelope filled with $2,500. After the fat fuck counted it, he gave my pops a bigger yellow envelope with his new paperwork. Pops opened it and checked it all out. A birth certificate, social security card, driver's license, and utility bills, all with his new name, Carlos Johnston. Back at the hotel, Pops told us he'd been living in San Jose. He'd met some broad out there and they were starting a new life together. Pops and I went to see Boys in the Hood that night near Marina Del Rey. It was opening weekend and shootouts and stabbings were erupting at theaters across the country. The theater was packed. We jumped out our seats when my song Too Young started playing during the backyard barbecue scene when Ice Cube came home from prison. He was proud that his son accomplished something like that. That was the last time I got to hang out with my pops. 9 months later, the feds finally found him in San Jose. He had a good run, though. 5 years. He did 2 years in a federal prison in California. Then they shipped him to a fed joint in Georgia for another few. Back in New York, I hung out in QB every day with Haz's friends. Jamel and Jamal were twins. You could tell them apart because Jamel had two razor scars on his cheeks. A long one on the right cheek and a short one on the left from a brief Rikers Island bid. Someone came up behind him with two razors and cut him on both sides. We called Jamal Twin Gambino and Jamel the Scarface Twin. Then there were Ron Gotti, Ty Nitti, and Tripp, who came to be known as Godfather. Karate Joe, who was a martial arts expert. Yammy, the Golden Gloves boxer. Free High, who smoked everybody weed and never chipped in or bought his own. Capone, who had a reputation for supposedly shooting a cop and cutting people with razors. Draws, who we called Super Trooper because he survived numerous shootouts and had been shot multiple times. Rap and Spark, two older laid-back hustlers who didn't hang out with us much because they were wiser than us. Though when they did come around, they'd advise us to stop all our young-minded shit and just get money. Prince Guard, who always was just coming home from jail. Ops, a.k.a. Dead On, because he knocked dudes out with one hit. And Tawan, they called him Noid, because he looked like the Domino's Pizza character, the Noid. He was the only one in the crew with his own apartment, no parents. He was the same age as Havoc and me, who was on his own because his mom's reportedly got locked up for cutting off her man's finger and left him with the crib. That was the hangout spot. We called it the Honeycomb Hideout. Noid had another nickname, the Natural Born Hustler. He had to pay the bills and support himself. He moved to QB 5 years prior from Red Hook Projects in Brooklyn. He didn't speak to me much and wasn't friendly at first, but I was a new face, so I didn't expect them to be. I'm that same way with people. The twins were also hard on me when I first came around. They told me if I wanted to be down with their crew, I had to battle every rapper in Queensbridge. So we got some E&J and weed, and we walked around the entire projects, and I had to battle whoever was outside who had a name. I was getting busy. The twins would amp me up. Yeah, this my nigga P. Y'all can't fuck with his verses. Finally, they told me I had to battle Nas. It was around 10 p.m. on a Friday night. We were all drinking outside in front of Havoc's building. Come on, let's go see if Nas is over on the block, Twin Gambino said. Nas, Jungle, and Grand Wiz sat on the same bench on 40th side of Vernon every night. That was their bench. Havoc's and Nas's blocks were on opposite ends of the projects. You had to cross a hill in order to get to the other side. You could go through the blocks, but most people crossed the hill. The two sides, the 40th and the 41st sides, beefed with each other sometimes. Nas and them were sitting on the bench as usual. Yo, I got my man P right here. He wanna battle you, Gambino said. Nas was nonchalant, like, alright, corny little dude. Who does this kid think he is coming around to battle me? That's Nas. Everybody knew how nice he was back then. I had a little lick in me, so I was feeling myself. It was time to battle Nas. The twins and I stood next to Nas and two of his boys on the bench. I was nervous as hell. I spit, Nas spit, then I spit some more. We lit a blunt and passed it around between raps. When I heard Nas rhyme, I thought, damn, I can't say no shit better than that. His is way better than mine. He told me my shit sounded cool, and his boy said the same. I knew Nas had the better rap, but the twins always encouraged me. You the best, P. You the best. Nas was the best. Havoc was better than me, too. We shook hands, then the twins and I walked back over to Has Block on the 41st side. You doing your thing, P, but just one more person you gotta battle, they said. If he says you good, then you good. Who is he? I asked. Where's he at? You gotta wait. He's locked up right now. His name is called Mega. If you can hang with Mega, then you can hang with us. Everybody in the hood said that Mega was 100 times better than Nas, and Nas was fucking good. They had me scared to death to battle Mega. Mega was supposedly locked up for a crime he didn't even commit. Some white chick had been mugged and pointed Mega out while she was sitting in the back seat of a cop car and he was minding his business. He got 5 years for that bullshit. I was 17 years old in 1992, but in my heart and my mind, I was more like 25. I moved out my mom's apartment and practically lived at Hav's mom's crib with him, his brother TJ, his sister Tamika, his mom's and her boyfriend. Once I got a taste of the largest housing projects in North America and became a part of the action, it was addictive. 6 blocks, 96 buildings, every block had a crew. Hav's crew was the 12th Street crew, from the 41st side of 12th Street. Mostly everybody sold crack and had money rolls in their pockets. The excitement of QB hooked a lot of people in with his new slang, unique style of dress, and cool characters. Queensbridge had its own way of doing things. We cuffed the bottom of our pants different, laced our shoes different, even tied them different, looping the laces through every other hole. People get sucked into that hood. They say New York is fast-paced. Well, QB is triple that speed, mentally. We had to think fast, react fast, and have animal instincts in order to survive in that hood. Crackheads from different states and countries would find their way to Queensbridge because in QB, they sold big, loose rocks in their hands instead of a bunch of tiny pieces stuffed in a crack vial like other hoods. We call crack hemis, cigarettes bogeys, and St. Oz malt liquor, thaney. The word thaney came from our own cryptic speech, something like pig Latin. This kid Bumpy started it, and I dubbed it the Thun language. For example, instead of calling each other son, we said Thun. And Thorty instead of Shorty. It got real intricate. Bumpy had a speech impediment that made him talk like that, naturally. But we all turned it into our hood slang. We even had slang terms for money. A $100 bill was called a man. 50s were half a man. 20s, dubs. 10s, demons. And a 5 was a fever. We called the police Jakes from the 80s TV show Jake and the Fat Man. And the phone was a jack. Jewelry was shine or special effects. Oral sex was called a head spin. And regular sex was a backspin. We were doing and saying shit nobody had ever seen or heard before. One afternoon, Twin Gambino knocked on the door and told me Cormega was home and it was time for us to battle. I reluctantly got up and followed him outside to the card table where Mega was posted up on a set of crutches. I introduced myself, and he explained how he'd broken his leg in a motorcycle accident as soon as he got home. After the small talk, we started rapping. Mega was definitely better than all of us. The way he put his rhymes together, his wordplay was extra unique. I was scared to rap after him, but I did. Mega said he liked my shit. I was in. I passed the test. Twin Gambino told me that after I battled Nas, Nas told everybody I sounded weak and corny and Havoc should go solo. I wasn't surprised. Even I thought I was whack compared to Nas. Although Gambino never made me feel that way. He told me that in his opinion, I could be better than him. Man, fuck Nas, Gambino said. Don't listen to him, he's just jealous. To me, Nas was the best there was. I never had any sour feelings towards Nas. I looked up to him. Gambino telling me that Nas said I was whack only fueled me. I grew to love Havoc, his family, his friends, and Queensbridge so much that I wasn't going to let anything make them turn around and say, P's whack, let's cut him off. From that day on, I went on a rap mission because I wanted to be accepted by my new friends. I didn't want Had to go solo. It sparked a fire in me. I would like to thank Nas, the Twins, Havoc, and the entire 12th Street crew for bringing me into y'all world. I love y'all. Chapter 4. Juvenile Hell. Buying new gear, nothing but the best. Forget Levi's, strictly Polo and Guess. But how do I make the cash? It gotta be easy and it gotta be fast. Peer pressure. Hav and I did a few talent shows and went to a lot of industry parties in 1992. Still trying to get signed after the Def Jam incident. Since we were so young and the smallest dudes at the parties, music industry people started to take notice. Matty C, a writer for the Source Magazine's Unsigned Hype column, decided to feature us in the magazine. I bought like 20 copies when it hit the stand. Slick Rick was on the cover. I was amazed. We were in a magazine. Matty played our music for Bones Malone and A&R at 4th and Broadway Records. He wanted to sign us immediately and had a contract ready within a week with the $20,000 advance. We had a falling out with my moms just before we made the deal. We'd made it past the first few rounds of auditions at a New York talent search, and my mother had taken us to the main audition in the projects on the Lower East Side. When our song, Aw Shit, came on, the dude in charge was like, stop the tape. You can't curse. We got into an argument, and they kicked us out the show. Fuck you! Fuck this show! We shouted. You gonna remember us! My mother didn't curse. She was a real positive person, into new age thinking. You can't talk to people like that, she said. This is a business. Moms, Mobb Deep is the best that there is in rap music, I said. Guaranteed, we're better than anybody that's in that show. You can't go around thinking and talking like that, Mom said. Listen, if you don't think we're the best, you shouldn't be managing us, he told her. Mom was right. We shouldn't have cursed that dude out. But of course, we're supposed to feel like we're the best. Our new manager was this dude named Dave, a well-dressed, soft-spoken guy from Queens with a good business mentality. Havoc found him somewhere. Mom was pissed. She spoke to her friend Brenda Dash, a real authentic psychic, about it. Just leave them alone. They're going to learn on their own. Brenda, who's Damon and Stacy Dash's aunt, told her. She eventually listened to Brenda and fell back. Moms didn't think 4th and Broadway was a good deal, but we just wanted the dough and our videos on TV. Dave negotiated a good deal for us, in our opinion. We signed a deal. Early the next morning, Havoc came knocking on my door, hyped up, with the first half of our advance money. My moms had moved to Jersey City for a little while to get away from Left Rack after I was arrested for selling crack my freshman year. I wouldn't wake up until Hav eventually started banging. Still groggy, I opened the door, and Hav stood there smiling with a mouthful of gold teeth. 10 separate caps lining his top row, a brand new Pele Pele leather jacket, and an envelope full of cash. What's this? I asked. I picked up our advance today, he said. We split $12,000, $6,000 apiece. Come on, let's go shopping. I learned how to make beats in my grandmother's basement with Grandpop's records. My grandfather left me his entire jazz collection from all his travels. Looking back at his life and the way he died, I realized that Grandpop's did it real big. His friend Quincy Jones detailed a lot of their wild times on tour in his autobiography. Grandpop's died while touring the world at age 73. I used to think, I want to go out just like that. But as I got older, I realized that I wanted to live much longer. A handful of our songs were sampled from his collection. We rushed, recording the whole album at 510 Studio, and didn't try hard to make hit records. I spent $2,200 on some studio gear and taught myself how to make beats. Hav would come to the crib and watch me put ideas together in the basement. I taught him how to use the equipment. He picked it up fast. Hold up, let me try something real quick, he'd say while I was working on a track. Then he'd hog it for hours. I swear, it seemed like Hav was guided by spirits when he was on that sampler. He had this blank yet intense look in his eyes, like he was possessed. I let him do his thing. It was really kind of amazing. After a while, I'd leave the basement while he was working on a track, smoke a blunt, drink a 40 with my Long Island crew, come back with food and beer for Hav, and he'd be done. Then we'd work on the lyrics. Hav used to write some of my rhymes because my style and flow didn't match the unique style and flow he had coming from Queensbridge. He wrote my rhyme on Peer Pressure and a couple of other songs on that album. But after that, I caught on just as fast as he caught on with the beats. I put my own twist on it. And when I wrote verses, I write some of my rhymes because my style and flow didn't match the unique style and flow he had coming from Queensbridge. He wrote my rhyme on Peer Pressure and a couple of other songs on that album. But after that, I caught on just as fast as he caught on with the beats. I put my own twist on it, and when I wrote verses, I always felt a higher power guiding me. It surprised me when I wrote sometimes. Not the things that I said, but the way I said it. Like a force in my head was telling me, no nigga, say it this way. We made 3 beats on that album, but we just started learning how to make them. So that's exactly how the beat sounded. Amateur. We shot 2 videos, one for a song called Hit It From The Back in Laurelton, Queens, and another for Peer Pressure in the Lower East Side, Manhattan. Our album Juvenile Hell was released in 1993, a year after we recorded it, and was a flop. It sold a little over 20,000 copies, and the label dropped us quick fast. We learned a serious lesson. We had to take songwriting and producing seriously, or we wouldn't get another chance. Our excuse was that we were only 17 when we recorded the music. Just kids. We were still learning. But there are no excuses in this business. You either do or you die. While we were on the promo tour for the album, Nas dropped the Illmatic album. That really overshadowed our feeble attempt at rap music. Illmatic was, and still is, one of the best rap albums ever. Nas was an incredible songwriter, and the beats he chose were just as good. Halftime, produced by Lost Professor, was the best song out. During an in-store appearance in Washington, D.C., they were playing that song. When I attack, there ain't an army that can strike back, so I react never calmly on the hype track. Whenever I freestyle, I see trap, niggas say I'm wild. I hate a rhyme, bite his rhyme. Stay tuned, now soon the real rap comes at halftime. It made us want to hurry home and start working on a new album. Even though Juvenile Hell wasn't a big success, the U.S. promotional tour across California and the entire East Coast built us a cult following. While we were in Cali, it blew our minds to find fans who had cassettes of the entire 50-song demo we recorded in Coney Island. For our demo to travel from New York across the map to Cali before the internet or mixtapes meant that people were really feeling us. We did college and underground radio interviews. In New York, Stretch Armstrong and Bobbito were among the first to show us love and play our music on Columbia University's radio station, WKCR. The Nas Illmatic craze helped boost our popularity because DJs and press people were always asked, "So, you're from the same hood as Nas, huh?" The Hit It From The Back video was so erotic, filled with fat asses and explicit lyrics, that it started getting burned on the Playboy channel. "Cunt little stunt with my butter dick, shorty. You talk too much, so lay back and enjoy the blunt." So like I said, we made ourselves a little cult following. One night around Halloween, we did a show at the Nottington House, a small spot right behind the Rib Shack restaurant on Linden Boulevard in Jamaica, Queens. While we were on stage performing, Hit It From The Back, a bunch of dudes in the crowd were giving us a cold stare. "We tired all that Queensbridge shit," they started yelling. "Fuck Queensbridge, Southside, nigga." Pandemonium broke out when we got off the stage. People throwing bottles and chairs and running everywhere. Come to find out, it wasn't just South Jamaican niggas tired of all the Queensbridge hype. This kid named T, who was on stage with us that night, had beef with some dudes out there. Man, they was trying to kill him. The brawl inside erupted to gunfire outside. Hundreds of shots let off that night. The Camry we rode away in just so happened to be the car T rode in. We had to duck in the car floor because bullets were blasting through the windows. This fool almost got us killed. When we got the news from our manager that the label had dropped us after the album tanked, we were already working on new music, so it fueled us. We fired our manager Dave and hired this girl Keisha, our man LeBron from Art and Design's sister. Keisha had her own apartment in Harlem on 149th Street and St. Nicholas Ave, almost directly across the street from the famous Branson candy store. Keisha invited Havoc and me to move in with her. We took her up on that offer. Havoc and I still use our little studio at my crib, but spent most of our time at Keisha's. The neighborhood had tons of females. Keisha had this fine-ass cousin named Dahlia who would come over to do Keisha's hair and nails. Dahlia was bad as hell.